United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. This is Judge Allen, and I'm joined this morning by my colleagues, Judge Toth and Judge Lohr. We're convened by video conference to hear argument in the matter of Larry S. Helmick against Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 19-5290. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please make your appearance for the record?
Good morning, Your Honors. This is Andrew Cho on behalf of the appellant, and with me as co-counsel is Dan Wiedemeyer.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ryan Harrison. Seated in second chair is James Cowden, Deputy Chief Counsel. We represent the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Dennis McDonough.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Mr. Cho, I assume you are reserving some time for a rebuttal?
Yes, 10 minutes, please.
Yes, we'll make that happen, and you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning again, Your Honors, Judge Allen, Judge Toth, Judge Lauer. May it please the court. This appeal challenges the board's denial of accrued benefits stemming from a loan provided by the appellant, Larry Helmick, to his mother, Lois Helmick, to help her out with mounting medical expenses as her health rapidly worsened in 2010 and 2011. To help alleviate this enormous financial burden, Mr. Helmick provided a loan of $15,000 so that his mother could pay off her assisted living expenses until she received an improved death pension from VA, for which she had applied in February 2011. Unfortunately, Ms. Helmick passed away in April 2011, and it was not until March 2012 that VA's Pension Management Center finally granted the improved death pension. VA's delay in processing resulted in a pool of due and unpaid funds from which the decedent would have paid back the loan had she received it before she passed away. Given these events, appellant filed for accrued benefits in June 2011, which gave rise to the claim now on appeal. We outlined in our briefs three overarching errors in the board's decision. One related to the adequacy of the board's reasons or bases regarding the accrued benefits issue. One related to compliance with an August 2018 joint motion for remand, and one related to fair process. We believe that each warrants remand of the April 9th, 2019 board decision, and I plan to discuss these errors in that order. Turning to the first error, we believe that the board's reasons or bases regarding the accrued benefits issue are inadequate for two main reasons. The first relates to the board's factual findings regarding a February 2011 medical expense report, namely that its findings are inconsistent with the nature and purpose of the loan as established by the record. Now, regarding the medical expense report, the decedent certified in February 2011 that she incurred unreimbursed medical expenses and certified that they were as paid by her. The board relied on this to then conclude
This is Judge Allen. I'm sorry to throw you off, but it seems to me that in looking at this case, which amazingly has been pending back and forth for a decade, is all roads lead to one question for me, which is, does the phrase "bore the expense" mean something that is broader than paid, as in wrote the check, right? Because if in fact the language bore the expense is exactly the same, then all of the other reasons here sort of go away. In other words, it's true that the board set up this, what I'm going to call, you can't have your cake and eat it too logic, meaning you can't claim one thing and do the other. That actually, I think, is only true if bore the expense means the same thing as paid. So first of all, do you agree with that, that is the central regulatory or statutory question? And even if you don't agree with it, help me with your view about why bore the expense should mean more than paid.
So to answer your first inquiry, I believe that it is certainly an important statutory/regulatory question here. And As far as my interpretation goes, I believe that the two phrases are distinct in some respects, because Black's Law Dictionary defines bear, the present tense of bore, as to support or carry. And I think that that definition is very important here, because the appellant, by providing a loan to his mother to help tide her over until she received the improved death pension to then pay her medical expenses, essentially a bridge loan for all intents and purposes, thus helped support or carry his mother throughout that difficult time. So I think that with that definition in mind, it is very important to see that appellant can satisfy the regulatory requirement under 3.1000A5 to then establish his entitlement to accrued benefits.
Thank you.
So in counsel, in your estimation, how would this loan be reflected on her, in a sense, expense or income statement? How should it have been treated? And then how then in turn, so this is kind of a two-part question, should then VA have treated the loan, in a sense, as it's reflected in her income statement?
So I think the bottom line here is that we already know how VA treated it, which is that Pension Management Center used her unreimbursed medical expenses listed as $39,842 for 2010 and deducted that from her income, which it had determined was $17,000, to arrive at zero, which led to the maximum allowable rate payable for that year. In terms of how it should have been done, we know for a fact that they were deducted from her income as an unreimbursed medical expense pursuant to section 3.272G.
Right. I mean, I understand what in fact happened here, the actual sort of findings. I mean, but obviously, you're contending that that was suboptimal. How should it have happened? Like, how should everything have been characterized? You know, if you just walk us through the mechanics of almost reverse engineer this, how should this have been done correctly, in your opinion, in terms of not only accounting for the expenses, but then accounting for the benefits that would have accrued based on these expenses done properly?
So done properly, as we noted in our briefs, application of 3.272B would have been preferable, because that subsection also deals with deducting income to determine one's annual income for improved pension purposes.
Sure. So then it would not have been, it would have been excluded from her income statement, right?
So that I'm sorry, but to answer your question, yes, it would have been excluded. And by excluded, I basically mean deducted, which seems, at least to me, to be the purpose of the regulation. It deals with deducting certain allowable amounts from one's income to determine, do you meet a certain threshold of income to then qualify for an improved death pension? And if so, how much?
Okay. And then, you know, having deducted that or excluded that properly, I'm not an accountant, so these terms, I might use the wrong terms, but having excluded that income, would that change the pension amounts, the benefits that she would be entitled to?
As far as I can tell, not in this case. And I think what's important to recognize here is that the unreimbursed medical expenses, which were deducted from income, were so large to begin with. You have $39,842 for 2010. I think it was about $51,000 in 2011. And really, no matter how you go about the math, if you deduct the $10,000 loan that was provided for in 2010, as reflected by, I believe, a September 2010 and November 2010 check from the appellant, or the $5,000 loan for 2011, as reflected by a April 2011 check, either way, you get such a large amount of unreimbursed medical expenses that would, if deducted from her income of only $17,000, no matter what, will always lead you to the amount of zero. In other words, in my view, the amount that VA calculated that it owed her would not change under either scenario. It owed her $11,492, and that would not change whether or not you factor in the loan as an unreimbursed medical expense or not.
Okay, so you may have just answered the next question I was going to ask, which is, so you don't take issue with that $11,492 calculation, at least as to her benefits?
I do not. That is an amount that was calculated by VA that is due and unpaid, and it is a pool of money from which Mr. Helmick is now coming in under the regulation 3.1000A5 as an eligible accrued benefits claim. So yes.
Okay, thanks.
There are no further questions from the court. I will proceed where I left off. So essentially what we believe is that the medical expense report, that the board's findings as to it were inadequate in several respects. The first one I want to discuss is that the nature of appellant's loan is just that, it is a loan. This distinction is significant because if the board had recognized that appellant had provided a loan, then it may have not made the adverse finding on page 5 of its decision, which was that the appellant cannot seek reimbursement by now contending that he actually paid the expenses that were certified as paid for by the decedent. Now, the reason the nature of a loan is important here is because had they recognized it was a loan, then they would have potentially thought of, does Mr. Helmick satisfy 3.1000A5's requirement as a person who bore the expense? And as I responded to in a response to Judge Allen's question, I think that that would be the case here. So and I think,
Mr. Cho, remind me, the form, for lack of a better way, that the mother submitted, it uses the word paid with respect to unreimbursed medical expenses, correct?
Correct.
So again, this is what I mean about, for me, all roads leading back to this point, because Mrs. Helmick, it was Mrs. Helmick, I think, the mother's name. She answered the question about paid because she wrote the check, metaphorically, if you will, to the facility. If the words bore the expense are broader than paid, then the board statement that you just read is sort of mixing things up because it says Mr. Helmick didn't pay, but she said she paid. Well, that's treating bore the expense and paid to be equivalent terms, right?
That is correct. And I think that that sort of tension in the board's decision sort of underlies the argument in our briefs that we noted, which is that essentially you have to really look at the nature of the loan, and that by him providing a loan, that is consistent with bearing an expense under the regulation specifically governing accrued benefits.
So the reason I keep harping on this with you, because these seem like friendly questions to you, is that you're framing this as the board's reasons or bases, right? But the board's reasons and bases would only be inadequate on this point if for some, well, let me phrase it differently. If in fact bore the expense is broader than paid, if we look at the board decision and say that it treated those two things equivalently, but we hold that they aren't, I guess we can call that a reasons or bases problem. But the problem really is the board didn't address this under the correct legal standard, right? Because that's what we would then be reviewing de novo, right? We'd be reviewing de novo, what does bore the expense mean? And if we conclude that it doesn't mean paid, then we have to send this back because the board would not have made the necessary factual findings, because it seems as if the board proceeded along the basis that bore the expense means paid and paid means bore the expense. Are you with me with that?
I am, and I do largely agree that that will be one way in which the board's error would necessitate remand here, because there are factual findings regarding payment, who bore the expense, the nature of the loan, and the purpose of the loan, which I want to discuss next, all of which I think may warrant remand here. So to move on to my next point, I think that the purpose of the loan is really important here as well, because the board, at least in my view, made a broad finding regarding all medical expenses, but did not account for the fact that the decedent certification was only for 2010 expenses. What that means here is that there are 2011 expenses that we know for a fact that the decedent did not certify as paid by her, but for which there's evidence in the record in the form of an April 2011 check from the appellant that he could then properly, or at least reasonably, claim that he paid or bore the expense under the regulation to support his entitlement to accrued benefits.
So, and let me stop you, right? Because again, right, not hiding my cards here, you just did exactly what I'm being critical of the board about, right? Which is, you said, this is evidence that he paid or bore the expense, okay? So that check, as far as I understand it, that check is not something that was paid to the facility, right?
Correct.
So would you agree with me that there, that if we were to hold that bore the expense means paid, right? I'm going to colloquially use the phrase wrote the check, right? I actually wrote the check to the assisted living facility. If we say bore the expense means exactly the same thing, there is no evidence that your client paid the expense, right, on that basis.
I would tend to agree. And I guess I apologize for conflating those two terms. To be clear, our position is that he did bear the expense.
Right. Yeah, and I'm not being critical. I will tell you, I've, you know, been a judge now for 3.5 years. I've had a bunch of these cases, usually about burial expenses. It's never been an issue about this. It's always been, you know, how much was it or something. But I'll tell you, until I had this case, I just in my head treated bore the expenses paid. I just it never crossed my mind that there's a difference, perhaps. And so that's what I'm trying to focus on. So here, if we were to hold that the statute means that you actually have to pay, yes, it used the phrase bore the expense, but it pay, you got to write the check. There is no evidence here, and the board's decision is right on that. There might be other reasons about, you know, the switching of theories and all of that. I'm leaving that aside. But on the law, it would be right. So I just wanted to be clear that when you said that that could be evidence that he paid, you weren't actually saying that there's potentially some evidence that even on the narrow interpretation of writing the check to the facility, that there's some evidence of that, because I didn't see that.
That is correct. There is no, at least as far as I know, explicit evidence that he directly wrote a check to the nursing home facility.
I'm going to stop you for a second because it looks to me, if I'm not mistaken, that we have lost Judge Lohrer. Do you concur, Judge Toth?
Check.
So apparently the internet gods tried to strike me, but struck Judge Lohrer. So we will pause the proceedings here and we should pause the clock. Thanks, John. And we'll see if we can get Judge Lohrer back.
Judge Allen, this is Greg Block, the clerk. Our IT guys have been on the phone with Judge Lohrer, and he's trying to reboot his computer. So maybe we can hold on for another few moments.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mr. Block.
I'm going to step away for 1 minute. So I'll be back in 1 minute, hopefully. Judge Lohrer will be on by then.
All right, I'll hold the fort, Judge Toth. Welcome back, Judge Lohrer.
Thank you. It's unclear what happened, but I can see all of you at least right now. Thank you.
Well, I take full responsibility for your internet problems. I'm sorry, but that's what happens with the junior judge on the panel. So, Mr. Cho, you can continue. I believe that you were responding, I think, just finishing up my point that when you use the term colloquially that this evidence could show, you were not maintaining that it actually could show he actually paid in the sense of writing the check to the facility.
That is correct. And I think that Mr. Helmick did bear an expense here because he provided a loan and he was not made whole precisely because his mother passed away before she received the improved death pension with which she would have repaid the loan had she received that prior to her passing. So because Mr. Helmick was essentially not made whole, or in other words, because he is essentially out money, it is reasonable to conclude that he bore the expense. And to add on to that, I think that the Congress's intent is evidenced by the fact that it used the term bore the expense. If it had meant to say pay, then I would imagine it would have said that. And I think that a canon of statutory construction is to give effect to these terms. And I would, subscribe to that belief here is that Congress used the word bear an expense that is clearly different than paid. And that based on the facts in the case here, that I think that there is an argument that Mr. Helmick did bear this expense. He, as I referenced in an earlier response, Black's Law Dictionary defines it as to support or to carry. And I think that that is exactly what he did here. This was a bridge loan to help tide his mother over in her last moments. And she needed this money until she received her approved death pension. And she didn't really know when she was going to pass away, but she definitely had the intention of paying back her son at the time had she received that money. And I think that altogether, we can look at this case as an issue that, that we can look at this as, a reasonable circumstance where where Mr. Helmick probably did bear an expense to some extent. And I think that that is, at least raised here and that the board should have discussed that in its statement of reasons or bases. Now, I do see that my time is winding down, so I want to wrap up this point and quickly move on to the other two arguments raised in our briefs, namely the second point regarding the August 2018 joint motion for remand granted by this court. It was explicit in its terms, discussed the last sickness issue. On the decision on appeal, the board essentially ignored it. It said we had created a separate and independent basis on which to deny the claim. And for the reasons just discussed, as well as the points raised in our briefs, we believe that the board did not have a valid basis to essentially ignore the terms of the JMR.
So let me ask you on that point, and we've asked a lot of questions of you, and by we, I think I mean principally, but so I'll give you more time, so don't worry about that. But let's just assume for a moment that the bore the expense means paid and only paid. Okay? You with me on that hypothetical? And Dawn, when the time expires, you can add 5 minutes. Okay. The board gets this back. Now, leave aside that this had been going for years and nobody seemed to raise this point. Leave that aside. If now the board member looks at this and says, well, I know the Court of Appeals told me to look at last sickness, but in fact, it turns out that he never paid. In that case, what would be the purpose of remanding for the board to discuss that? Because even if this was for her last sickness, if in fact the board was right that he didn't pay, and that's what the statute requires, it seems to me that would be a fool's errand for the board.
Do you
see what I mean, right? Because if somebody has to pay for the last expenses, and if they didn't pay, it doesn't matter whether they're last expenses or not, right?
I would agree on that point. If in your hypothetical, which I think is distinguishable from the facts here, if the appellant had, if for the expense means pay and the appellant did not pay, then the last sickness issue would essentially become moot because there are several elements to satisfy accrued benefits under the statute and regulation. We have board expense.
Right. So this is my point that although you've packaged these issues in boxes, this is not critical, it's descriptive, in different ways, right? Fair process, failure to comply with the remand, the reasons and bases. All of them, though, require that we determine whether bore the expense is broader than paid, right? Because if bore the expense only means paid, then I can't see how the board meaningfully erred in not complying with the remand because it would have been a useless exercise.
That is correct. And I think that this does dovetail well, or I'm sorry, it transitions well into the third argument regarding fair process, which is that if Mr. Helmick had been afforded any notice or opportunity to respond with evidence and argument, then this would have been an instance where he could have supplanted the, corroborated his statements and bolstered his positions, provide clarifying documentation, or perhaps the testimony of lay witnesses. I think the record shows that he has two brothers who may have been involved in this process.
I'm sorry because I am sounding like a broken record, but if in fact bore the expense only means paid, are you contending that he could have produced evidence that he actually paid?
That I'm certainly not, ruling that possibility out, because to me, this seems like a case where there was not enough development by the board. There are questions regarding the loan and the payments. And I think,
let me ask you this though. I mean, so it seems to me the evidence is pretty clear. If I remember it, there are three checks written from, we're going to treat it as coming from him. It came from a trust. To the mother, right? And so we have clear evidence of money going from him to the mother. Now, if bore the expenses broader, it might matter then that the mother turns around and pays the living expenses, right? But if bore the expenses only paid, I'm not sure what more development there would be because there's only $15,000 at issue. There are three checks for $5,000. They go from him to the mother with, right? I mean,
I do agree that if bear the expense means paid, then like you mentioned, that may be a fool's errand. But I think, the thrust of fair process here is that Mr. Helmut really didn't get a chance to meaningfully participate in his claim. And we simply don't know what he could have done to help his case if he had known that, bear the expense or payment or whether he had paid were issues that the board was thinking of and that the board found dispositive in denying his claim. So I think that, that's why fair process is a concern here in general. But I do agree with your assessment that bearing the expense is a primary concern here and that with the facts we have here, I think that we can make a case that he did bear the expense and that at the end of the day, the board's reasons or bases for denying the claim really did not grapple with this issue in a way that would, inform the appellant of the reasons for, of the precise reason for his, of the adverse finding or to permit informed review by this court. So I do see that my time is expiring and I would like to save my remaining time for rebuttal. So I will just conclude that we believe that for all of these reasons just discussed and in our briefs, we believe that the April 9th, 2019 board decision should be vacated and the matter remanded. Thank you.
Judge Toth, do you have any follow-up questions?
I don't, thanks.
Judge Lohrer?
One, thank you, Judge Allen. Mr. Cho, would you agree that the board never addressed the issue of the person who bore the expense and rather focused solely on the dual payment concerns that they had? In other words, I've read and reread the board decision multiple times, and it's absolutely silent with respect to that issue.
I do agree with your assessment. The whole issue of bearing the expense was not on the board's mind. I believe it did not cite to the pertinent regulation 3.1085. And as far as I can tell, Its denial rested on two suppositions, namely that two parties cannot both claim that they paid for an expense, and that by the decedent certifying that she paid for the expenses, that the appellant cannot now state that he paid those expenses. But I think that we provide convincing responses to both of those points in our briefs as well.
Precisely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cho. You'll have your full rebuttal time. Mr. Harrison.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Ryan Harrison. Seated in second chair is James Cowden, Deputy Chief Counsel. We represent the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Dennis McDonough. At issue in this case is appellant's claim of entitlement to additional accrued benefits in excess of those already paid to reimburse him for burial expenses. Specifically, he seeks to recoup some $15,000 in loans made to his mother, the decedent, prior to her death, which she used to personally pay for the assisted living expenses. We ask this court to affirm the board's decision for two reasons. First, the evidence of record does not demonstrate that appellant is the person who bore the expenses. And second, because the decedent and not appellant is the person who bore the expenses, the board did not err in not addressing the secondary causes of death. Turning to our first point, irrespective
of— President, let me ask you. So, I mean, what import is it that she reported this as a, you know, to deduct her expenses? What significance does that have in terms of whether she bore the expense? Walk me through the relationship between, since the reporting of income and the bearing of an expense.
Your Honor, I'll take your question in two parts. First, the 2011 medical expense here clearly shows that the decedent here certified that she paid the assisted living expenses here. The payments made to the assisted living facility are the expenses at issue. In certifying that she paid for those expenses, and as the form clearly instructs claimants to report only those medical expenses actually paid by you, she understood the arrangement of the loan to be that she was receiving the money and then she would be paying the assisted living facility directly. VA then relied on that certification in granting the improved death pension benefits. But second here.
So can I, before you go on to the second part, right? VA's form asked her to state expenses that she paid, right?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor.
And there's no dispute that she paid this, right? I mean, she paid it, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. And that brings me to my second point. There's no evidence or assertion to the contrary that the arrangement had changed in 2011 or that she did not bear the pay.
No, but my point is, when VA wrote its form, it asked the person to do a task. And the task was write down things that you have paid, right? Now, the regulation that we're dealing with respect to Mr. Helmick uses the phrase bore the expense. If those two things are synonymous, then I think the board's on pretty solid ground that two people can't simultaneously pay something, right? But if those things mean different things, then it is possible that somebody could pay, meaning I wrote the check, and somebody else could actually have borne the expense. Right. And so, I mean, I this is a silly example, but, you know, assume that I give a pot of money to my son to register for his competitive soccer team. If somebody said to him, well, did you pay the coach? He could validly answer yes. But if somebody said to me, did you bear the expense for that soccer? I could validly answer yes, even though I didn't technically pay in terms of actually providing it directly to the person, right? So again, I go back to what I'm saying to the appellant. To me, all of these things relate to that one point, right? Does bear the expense mean only paid, or is it a broader term that can capture something else? So after you finish answering Judge Toth's point, I really would like the government's view on that, because that for me is the most critical part of this.
Yes. First, getting to my second point. Here, there's no evidence or assertion made by the appellant that he paid the assisted living facility. Throughout the proceedings here, there's always been the additional caveat that a loan was made and that his mother paid the assisted living facility. So there's no evidence to the contrary, other than what is declared by the decedent here, that she paid for the expenses. Now, Judge Allen, to take your question, we are of the position that, as you stated earlier, that BOR is no broader than paid. However, while I cannot conceive of a scenario in which a loan could qualify as the person bearing the expense within the words of the statute or the regulation, I think it's helpful here to fall back on the question or on the facts of this case and say that the court doesn't really need to hold one way or the other.
So, just on this statutory point, what struck me is when I was rereading the statute this morning or last night, it's a blur. Congress used the phrase bore the expense, and I think in exactly the same sentence uses the word paid for something else. But I mean, it uses the word paid simultaneously with bore the expense. If we're going to say that Congress, because I'm a big believer that, you know, we can second guess what Congress does, you know, when we're off the clock, but when we're on the clock as judges, if it's clear what Congress does, then our job is to enforce it, right? And I would need serious convincing that Congress meant bore the expense to mean paid and only that narrow definition of paid when it actually used the term paid in the same sentence, right? So how could I be convinced, do you think, that those two terms are synonymous in that scenario?
Well, Your Honor, looking to the text of the statute, I think paid is used in the context of payments made from VA. There'd be the payment of accrued benefits where there is a sufficient basis for entitlement on the basis of reimbursement. So those are payments coming from VA. I think Congress here distinguished the fact that it's for those payments are only going to the person who bore the expense. And bore the expense in this context seems narrower than what appellant is asserting it to be here. But again, I think it's worth noting here that the evidence here, this court doesn't necessarily need to, while it is an acceptable outcome on our behalf, the court doesn't necessarily need to answer the question of whether bore necessarily means and only means paid, because here we know who paid the expenses. And it's an uncontested fact in this case that the decedent here paid for the assisted.
Start with the assumption with me that bore the expenses broader than paid, just right. If that's the case, the mere fact that the evidence is uncontested that the mother paid, that would not then resolve the issue, right? Because the board never, well, I should say VA treated this as if it weren't a problem for years and years and years and years. But in the board decision we have, the board never adjudicated the question about whether he bore the expense, because it implicitly determined at a minimum that bore the expense means paid, because it relied on the certification that the mother paid it and said, well, you can't have your cake and eat it too. That's only true if bore the expense means paid, right? So if we determined that bore the expense is broader, wouldn't we have to send it back for the board to address that question? And if, depending on its answer to that question, then move on to the last sickness point?
No, Your Honor, because I think implicit in your question is equating a loan with the fact that we know who actually paid the assisted living facility. It's the expenses paid to the assisted living facility. There's a superior claim here. Rather than a loan, we know who paid the expenses. So even if this court were to decide that bore can be broader than paid. That may be true in some circumstances, but it's not true in this circumstance when we actually know who paid the expenses.
But wouldn't that be a factual determination? So listen, I'm with VA's position that I'm ascribing to you that, you know, in a lot of cases, because money is fungible, right? If for the expenses broader and could encompass, for example, a loan in a certain situation, right? Or could encompass my soccer hypothetical, right? Where I give it to an agent to do something, right? There are going to be a lot of factual questions that have to be wrestled with, because in a lot of circumstances, because money is fungible, the mere fact that it goes to one person and then that person makes a payment doesn't necessarily establish for the expense, right? But we couldn't do all of that in the first instance because the board never considered it, right? I mean, yes, it's true. We know the mother paid, but that can't be enough, right? Because that then goes back to equating paid and bore the expense, right?
Your Honor, I think that the fact that the, to answer your question more poignantly, no, I don't think additional development or additional fact finding would be needed if this court were to interpret bore to be broader than paid. That maybe additional fact finding would be needed if we took out of the equation the fact that we have evidence here that the decedent paid the assisted living facility. Say we took the 2011 medical expense report out of the question or out of the hypothetical here and just had the assertion of the loan. Then yes, then additional fact finding would be needed. But here, at least, we have the sort of backstop here on the factual determination that the parties are not contesting here, that the decedent paid for the medical, for the assisted living expenses.
And so I'm sorry, I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying, because I'm having, it's not you, it definitely it's not you. Is this, right? If in fact, I understand what you're saying is, even if for the expenses broader, we don't have to worry about that here because it's uncontested that the mother paid, right? What I'm trying to understand is how is that different than saying bore the expense means paid, right? Because if we say bore the expense is broader in such a situation that somebody can bear an expense even though somebody else physically pays, okay? If that's right, then the mere fact that it's uncontested that the mother's paid couldn't answer the question standing alone, right? Because there'd have to be something else. Because if it was, then functionally that says bore the expenses paid. If I'm misunderstanding the argument, definitely let me know, because this is obviously the most important point in the case for me.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that you're misunderstanding me. I think if we're looking for something additional beyond the uncontested facts here about who paid, I think one thing that we can look to is at least the purpose of the statute, in that Congress provided a narrow criteria for explaining who can be entitled to accrued benefits. And accrued benefits, or entitlement to accrued benefits, is not determined on the basis of equity. You know, it's important to underscore here that VA is not at fault for the fact that this loan was not repaid. There's no equitable basis provided in the law to provide that entitlement, at least given the facts of this case. So, Your Honor, I think we can look beyond the facts that the purpose of the statute to support that finding, that remand, even if this court were to find that bore is broader than paid, that remand still would not be necessary in this specific context. So while we agree that that bore, at least in this context, as the board explained, is equated to paid, I still, even if the court were to find otherwise, I don't think that remand is the appropriate option here when we know who paid the expenses. Briefly, if I can touch on the section 38 CFR 3.272B, the medical expenses or maintenance. I'd just like to underscore the point that whether we classify these expenses, the expenses at issue being the payments to the assisted living facility. Even if we retroactively recategorize them as maintenance, the outcome, as the appellant noted, is the same. It just gives us a sum of money, like in the pot of leftover improved death pension benefits. Recategorizing the expenses as maintenance does not give rise to entitlement to accrued benefits. That's governed by a separate statute, separate regulatory regime here. So it's almost sort of like a red herring in this case, because whether we categorize them one way or the other, it doesn't make the case any different. The underlying facts are the same, that this is a loan and that the decedent here certified that she paid for those expenses. So her claim here, or her declaration rather, sort of trumps the assertion that a loan is somehow sufficient in this context. So we dispute the argument that that the regulation regarding maintenance versus medical expenses was recently raised by the record, or that the board somehow erred in not addressing it. Turning to our second point here, because the decedent and not appellant is the person who bore the expenses, the board did not err in not addressing the secondary causes of death. Now, the board here noted expressly the terms of the prior JMR here. It said that such discussion, rather, is not necessary in this context because we know who paid the expenses. It obviates the need to get into the additional discussion as to whether there's a sufficient nexus, if you will, between the expenses and the last sickness. So the board did address the JMR and it adequately explained why it did not need to get into the facts as to whether the last sickness here could have been caused by the decedent's secondary causes of death. And also with appellant's fair process argument here, I think that appellant's reliance on Bernard is misplaced here. It's sort of like comparing apples and watermelons, if you will, because that issue in Bernard was whether there was whether the claimant had submitted new and material evidence sufficient to reopen the claim. The board there found in the affirmative and then proceeded to adjudicate the claim on the merits. But the claimant there did not have the opportunity to present arguments regarding the merits, didn't have notice that the board would be proceeding to the merits, and was not apprised of the applicable laws and regulations. Here, however, entitlement to accrued benefits has always been at issue. The board had jurisdiction over that issue, and appellant has repeatedly been notified as to the applicable laws and regulations.
Mr. Harrison, it may be that this is an issue that doesn't have legal heft to it. But it does strike me that, and I would hope the secretary agrees, that this was certainly not best practices. This had gone along at the agency level for years with this issue never coming up. It came to the court, the secretary, the Office of General Counsel entered into a JMR in which it clearly was proceeding under the assumption that we were focusing on what was the last sickness. I hope the secretary agrees that it would have been better practice for the board to say, you know, on reflection, I think there's another issue here. It might be that if the board is right about the law, there's nothing that appellant could say. And to the extent this is a legal question, he's getting to make the arguments to us and we review it de novo. So right, any error blow would be harmless. But I've got to think that it would have been better for the board to give him some heads up that this was now going to be the basis for the decision. Don't you think?
Your Honor, I reject the premise that the appellant here wasn't on notice as to the board's finding here. Indeed, if we look back at the procedural history of this case, and while I do acknowledge that there have been errors in the procedural history here, his status as payor, as appellant frames it, has always been at issue. The board, or if we're looking back...
But why then would the secretary have entered into... I don't want to spend a ton of time on this, right? Because I don't think it has legal a legal effect. But why in the world then if the payor status was as clear as the board says it is, right, would the secretary have agreed to a remand to have the board discuss an issue that is much more factually complex, right? I mean, one of them was the stroke, the last illness, but the other one was look at something that happened 20 years ago and describe whether or not it was the last sickness. It seems to me that counsel could have reasonably taken that to mean that's the issue.
Your Honor, I will readily acknowledge that it's not ideal, the terms of the prior JMR here. I think it reflects the party's agreement on the identified errors in that prior decision, which is now vacated, and the JMR is tailored to those errors. There is at least the finding of fact that expressly states, this is on page 34 of the record or 22 of the record of proceedings, that appellant has not provided evidence of expenses that were paid by him. This sort of theory is throughout the procedural history of this case, that there's no evidence that he paid the expenses at issue. So the board's or VA's equating of the term bore and paid has been consistent throughout the adjudication of this claim. The fact that the prior board decision decided to move past that issue and proceed to the secondary causes of death, although inadequately, I don't think it's a fair way to characterize the adjudication of this claim as a whole. I think it's clear that appellant has been on notice of his, of the issue here being the status as payor and who actually bore the expenses.
Counsel, so am I correct in understanding you that if instead of kind of entering into this sort of loan agreement situation with his mom, he had just called up the facility directly and paid, you know, paid the bills right away. How does this work out differently, right? She obviously would then not have reported any of this on her income statement or on the VA form for medical expenses. And it sounds like the VA's position would be that he would then be entitled to these as accrued benefits. Am I missing something?
No, you're not missing anything, Your Honor. I think that's correct. If we changed the facts here such that there was evidence of payments made from the appellant to the assisted living facility, taking the loan out of the equation, taking the decedent out of the equation, I think that's right. I think that there would be sufficient evidence to demonstrate entitlement under those factual circumstances. Here, however, we're left with the facts that were given. There is a loan in place, and we know that the decedent here made the payments herself. And appellant has stated as much several times throughout the adjudication of this claim. For example, in his February 2016 statement, he states that the loans were made so that she could pay for her medical expenses in 2010 and 2011. It's on page 89 of the record or 39 of the record of proceedings. In his April 2015 statement, the appellant states, we loaned her money for her to pay for her increased cost of care. There's never been an assertion here that he somehow bypassed the loan and paid the assisted living facility directly. There's never been an assertion that the decedent here didn't pay the expenses. So I think the procedural history here, it's consistent in the facts here and the assertions here that there is a loan and that the loan was made so that the decedent could pay for the expenses herself. And that's exactly what happened here. So here, at least, there is evidence of who paid the expenses, who bore the expenses to the assisted living facility. And that is sufficient to support the board's findings of fact here and to show that their findings are plausibly based in the record. Your Honors, if there are no further questions.
Judge Toth?
I don't, thanks.
Judge Laura?
I just want to make sure I understand. So the VA is not contesting the fact that the appellant provided the loan to the decedent and that that amount of the loan was actually used to pay the expenses for assisted living. Is the VA conceding that?
Your Honor, I think that that is correct. I think that the dispute in the briefs, I think, was it reflects almost the parties talking past each other on this point. I think that we're on the same page here on this point. I think that the statement that appellant points to here, where the board says appellant cannot seek reimbursement by now contending that he actually paid the expenses, it's not rejecting the premise that a loan is in existence. It's rejecting the theory that a loan can indirectly establish entitlement to accrued benefits in this context. So I think that throughout the case here, VA has acknowledged the existence of the loan. I don't think that the board in the decision on appeal calls that fact into question. They're merely highlighting the fact that there's a difference between loaning money and somebody using that money to bear the expenses and actually paying the expenses themselves. So I think it supports our reading of the board's decision here as rejecting that theory.
And the portion of the board decision you just quoted or referred to with Judge Lohr, that also reflects the board's assessment that bore the expense and paid mean the same thing, right?
In this context, yes, Your Honor. I want to be cautious not to speak.
Well, no, but either the board determined that bore the expense and paid are equivalent terms, or the board determined that bore the expense is broader, but this didn't qualify, right? I mean, because it can't be that bore the expense means paid here, but bore the expense doesn't mean paid in the next case, right? I mean, either bore the expense means paid, or it means something broader than paid. Maybe this doesn't come within it, maybe it does, but I read the board's decision as pretty clearly establishing that it treated these terms the same. Are you saying that it didn't, and that it actually determined that bore the expense is broader, but this didn't qualify?
Your Honor, I think it's clear from the board's decision that its reasons or bases regarding whether bearing the expense is the same as paying the expense. I think it's sort of implied in the board's logic, but it's intentionally grounded in the facts of this case, because admittedly, there's not a lot of authority speaking to how to interpret the terms of the statute here. And I think that's why the board correctly grounded their analysis in the facts of this case and framing them as the same expenses. They can't both be the same expenses.
So two questions. Number one, I'd like you to tell me the secretary's position about the statutory interpretation question, whether bore the expense means paid or whether it means something different. And second, this follows on Judge Lohr's questions. If in a case where the facts are essentially accepted that appellant loaned his mother money for the purpose of making these expenses, and the mother then paid using the money that the son gave her, if bore the expense can mean anything broader than paid, it's difficult for me to see why that wouldn't qualify, right? Because I can't think of anything else that would, because that's just like such a perfect chain of causation. So if you could address those two points.
Your Honor, first, for the secretary's position on this, I'm not prepared to say that that is exactly how the secretary reads the statute. I think that that is an acceptable reading of the statute, and it's supported by the purpose of the statute as well as applied to the facts of this case. It leads to the appropriate result. That being said, I agree with you that I can't conceive of a scenario in which a loan would qualify. That's not to say it would never qualify, if that makes sense.
So help me out here. What could qualify if bore the expense means something than paid, i.e. writing the check to the facility or giving him a credit card or whatever, right? If a loan under these circumstances couldn't qualify as that broader thing, give me an example of something that would. I can't come up with one.
And admittedly, Your Honor, I can't either. We have wrestled with this question within our office, and we have not been able to conceive of a scenario or a loan would be sufficient. But if this court has reservations about reaching that question in its decision in this case, we think it's important to underscore the fact that the facts here are at least sufficiently developed that they can rely, that this court can rely on those facts in this case to say that the loan here, at least here, is not sufficient. Your Honors, if there are no further questions, then may I briefly conclude? I see that I'm almost out of time.
Absolutely. Take as much time as you need to wrap up.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's for these reasons that we ask this court to affirm the board's decision, because the evidence demonstrates that the decedent and not the appellant is the person who bore the expenses. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison. Mr. Cho, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honors. And rebutting the Secretary's points, I want to primarily focus on the issue of bearing the expense. Now, to be clear, we know who paid the expense for pension purposes, as evidenced by the fact that PMC granted the improved death pension to the decedent. But that is a distinct inquiry from who bore the expense for accrued benefits purposes. Now, it appears to me that the Secretary essentially agrees that the appellant did make a loan and that the loan likely did go to the decedent's medical expenses. And I think we know that the board did not make an adverse finding that the appellant did not loan the decedent the money, or that she did not use those loan proceeds to pay her assisted living facility costs. Now, I think with that background in mind, we also have to know that words have meaning, and that the phrase bear the expense, bore the expense in the statute and the reg must be given effect. The Secretary made certain points about how they could not conceive of a situation, at least in the facts in this case, that the appellant did not bear the expense, but I do not agree with that here. Like you mentioned, Judge Allen, in your hypothetical about your son's competitive soccer, I think that there are situations where if you have a loan, if you are the person footing the bill, if you're the person out the money, then I think you could reasonably be said to be a person who bore the expense. I think that that is what occurred here. And I think that at the very least, the board should have taken a deeper dive and provided a statement of reasons or bases to hash out this issue for both my clients, for both Mr. Helmick's purposes and for this court's judicial review. Again, I think the focus here is the statute. Congress would not have said bear the expense, bore the expense, if it had not intended to. It uses the word paid in other parts, but for accrued benefits, it says bear the expense. And I think a way to think about this is that 3.1000A5, if I'm not mistaken, says in all other cases, only so much of the accrued benefit, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that phrase in the beginning is important. In all other cases, to me, signals in the regulation that this is in some sense a catch-all. It is intending for all other cases, all other classes of persons to come under if they bear an expense. It is expanding the possibility in some circumstances of someone being able to claim accrued benefits. So essentially, I think that the focus here, like I mentioned again, is on the statute bearing the expense. I think that the facts here warrant, or at least, you know, counsel such a finding, that they reasonably support such a finding here. And I think that that is really the point that I want to stress in responding to the Secretary's point regarding the whole bearing the expense issue. Now, the second point I want to address is the applicability of Section 3.272B. I don't believe that this is a red herring in any respect, and I think that this regulation, this subsection, was raised to the extent that the board essentially invoked 3.272G in denying the claim. It made a great deal of, focused a lot on what the decedent did, her improved pension, what those expenses were. And I think that in doing so, that necessarily invoked 3.272G, which precisely provides for deducting those kinds of expenses from allowable income for pension purposes. And within that very same regulation, you have subsection B, which, as we noted in our briefs, could point to a favorable outcome for the appellant. So it should have addressed that point in its statement of reasons or bases in adjudicating the claim. And finally, I just want to touch on the fair process issue. The secretary attempted to distinguish Bernard here, but I think, again, that the focus here is on Smith, like we discussed in our briefs. Did the appellant have reasonable notice? Did he have a chance to meaningfully participate in his claim? Was he given the impression that a factual finding had been resolved in his favor? And I think that the status of payor, was he the person who, I guess, bore the expense? That was not reflected in the March 2015 statement of the case, in the August 2016 supplemental statement of the case, in the December 2017 board decision, or in the August 2018 joint motion for remand. This was not on the board's radar, on the RO's radar, on the agency's radar. How could it have been on Mr. Helmick's radar? So because he did not have notice of this issue, he did not have a chance to, you know, fight back and provide evidence to supplement the record and to really, you know, show and participate in his claim regarding the issue of whether he bore the expense to satisfy his entitlement to accrue benefits under both the statute and the regulation. So I think that I've briefly covered all the points that I want to discuss here. And I think that really what the court should focus on here is the language of the statute, the language of the regulation, and the facts of this case. It is reasonable to say that Mr. Helmick did bear an expense here, and that at the end of the day, the board's reasons or bases for denying his claim were simply inadequate because it did not really deal with this issue in a way that would effectuate meaningful review in this court. Thank you. And if there are any questions about this court, I'm happy to answer them.
Judge Toth?
No questions. Thanks to both of you.
Judge Laura?
I guess my only question for Mr. Cho would be whether there's a distinction here from Smith in that Smith involved a non-final remand decision, whereas that is not the case before the court.
I do recognize that that is a factual distinction here, but I think that, again, for the fair process argument, we're looking at the whole picture, right? Was Mr. Helmick given a chance to participate in his claim? If we look at the record, there were really no documents at all between the August 2018 joint motion for remand and the April 2019 decision on appeal. There was nothing to indicate that whether he bore the expense would be a reason for denying the claim, or any of the other reasons that the board invoked for denying the claim. So really, I think the whole picture is that he was not given a chance to, you know, participate in his claim and to any meaningful extent, and that looking at that issue more broadly is, I think, the proper focus in discussing and considering the applicability of Smith here.
Thank you. No further question.
All right. Well, we thank the parties for your argument. I understand, Mr. Cho and Mr. Harrison, this was both your first arguments. And so doing it in the midst of a pandemic to me would be overwhelming, but I want to compliment you. I thought you both did an excellent job and your arguments were very helpful to the court. And so with that, the case is submitted for decision.
And the court is in recess.